Workflow management company Smartsheet is out with better than expected sales and profits as the pandemic continues to see companies invest in digital workflow. But the stock is getting hit amid a mixed third quarter outlook for billings. Let's get the 411, so to speak, from Smartsheet CEO Mark Mader. Mark, always good to speak with you. Thanks for taking some time. Let's just swab the deck on the stock price reaction, down almost 10% here. I think some concern on the street about the billings guidance for the third quarter, marking it would be a slowdown compared to what you saw in the second quarter. Have you seen a slowdown in your business?
No, we had just posted a fantastic quarter, and it was the third quarter of sequential growth and acceleration. We are quite bullish on tackling what is a very young market in work management. We are just crossed the $500 million ARR threshold as a business, which is exciting. And we're looking to build a really durable company for the long term.
So you haven't seen, has there been a directional change in your business as people have gone back to the office?
I think it's more the category becoming known now and people trying to figure out how to empower their workforce to achieve more, whether that's on the collection of data, the management of data, and not only empowering the workforce, but also how do you do that in a way that's actually secure and enterprise grade? Because today, with all the security threat vectors coming at companies, it's not just about empowering your workforce and sharing within and across companies. It's how do you do that in a secure manner? And one of the things that's really helped fuel our growth in the last quarter is the release of what we call Smartsheet Advanced, which is our premium platform that allows people to both integrate to other systems very deeply and also govern, manage, and administer.
Hey, Mark, it's Julie here. I just want to, sorry to dwell on this for another moment. I just want to clarify the billings issue because you guys talked about it on the call and you clarified it there. And I just want to make sure for our audience that they have that clarification as well. So because of some sort of one-time items, year-over-year comparisons, your guide for billings this quarter is what, closer to 38, 39%? Is that correct?
Correct, on a normalized basis. And as you said, Julie, that one-time event of the acquisition of Brandfolder last year, the digital asset management platform, does cause that 4 or 5% headwind, that one-time headwind.
One of the other things that you guys talked about on the call is the growth that you've seen in particular in the healthcare space in terms of your clientele. What do you think is driving that? And do you expect that to continue to be, even though your clients are pretty diversified, do you expect that to continue to be an area of growth for you?
We do. And what we're seeing is such pressure on organizations to do more with the same or a fewer number of people. I think COVID especially has put such pressure on healthcare organizations as well as pharma companies to work more quickly and efficiently. I don't see any end in sight there. And those two sectors have been the fastest growing for us at over 50% year over year.
Another interesting, I think something you announced on the conference call, something called Smartsheet Regions. Explain to what that is. Are you hearing, it seems to be a focus on data privacy for your customers. Are you hearing from customers overseas that they don't want to route their data through a U.S. company?
Yes, not only through a U.S. company, but through the U.S. infrastructure. So many companies around the world buy from us. We serve customers in 190 countries. However, there are some companies in some regions which need to conform to privacy regulations. For instance, in Germany, the largest companies are unable and unwilling to have information stored outside of their borders. So we are going to be firing up the Frankfurt region through a public cloud provider here in the next month. And the largest companies in Europe will be able to now house their information fully within that region. And the reason I emphasize fully is because there are quite a few companies who do support residency partially, but still have certain pieces of information checkpoint back to the U.S. And what we're finding at the enterprise level is that people are looking for full residency as opposed to mostly resident.
Is this, Mark, is this just a Smartsheet thing, or is this something we might see across the tech landscape?
I think there's going to be more and more pressure, Brian, on companies to do that full compliance. The regulatory landscape is changing quickly. And this is one of those things that you can't change on the fly very cheaply if you're a provider. So it's really, you have to do it the right way from the outset. So we think that's a real competitive advantage for us in the coming years.
We've talked many times, Mark, throughout the pandemic. Your top line of your business continues to surge, but when do you think your company will be profitable?
Well, we've guided the street to a multi-year plan And we expect to go through the $1 billion revenue threshold in FY25, so calendar year 24. And right now, when as a collective, the public companies in our category are just about $1.1 billion of the total market, which we think is 25 to 30 today, it's all about reinvesting for growth. So the overages that we've enjoyed, our customers really driving demand for our software, we're putting right back into better services, better sales, better marketing. And we believe we're going to be able to generate, you know, 20+% operating margins here in the very near future. But right now it's about remaining the leader and taking the majority of that share.
All right, we'll leave it there. Smartsheet CEO Mark Mader, good to see you as always. Have a great rest of the week.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Julie.
We've got Grayscale CEO Michael Sonnensheim joining us today. And Michael, as you heard Jared, a lot to get through to in the crypto space. But I want to start by just talking about the moves that we have seen over the last few days. Obviously, don't want to make too much of just one move, but Bitcoin was down nearly 10% yesterday on the back of El Salvador's adoption of the currency. I wonder if you think this is a case of, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news. If it's tied at all, what do you make of the declines that we have seen in the last 24 hours?
Well, I honestly think for us, and certainly for our investors here at Grayscale, we don't focus too squarely on short-term movements in price. Instead, we're really looking at some of the recent action in the market, and some of these are really important milestones. Seeing a country like El Salvador actually make Bitcoin legal tender, I mean, that's an incredible milestone for this community. We've long believed that the emerging markets would be a really important place where we'd see Bitcoin adoption. And I think you're actually going to start to see a knock-on effect of other countries also considering this besides El Salvador.
Hey, Michael, good to be chatting with you today. Jared read through some of those tweets we saw from Brian Armstrong, but there was a couple here that stood out. And I know you've worked with the SEC for a while. There are a lot of companies looking to get their Bitcoin ETFs approved, but just want to read one piece of it where he was kind of describing a meeting with regulators in Washington and how he tried to meet with the SEC and they didn't want to meet with him. He said the SEC was the only regulator that refused to meet with me, saying we're not meeting with any crypto companies. This was right after they had become the first crypto company to go public in the U.S. He followed up with that Gensler had just been confirmed a month prior, so he brushed it off as the SEC still getting its feet under it. He says, now I'm not so sure. And my question to you, I guess, because we're hearing a lot of the people in the crypto community really attacking the SEC today, whether or not you believe that kind of this is more pressure to just kind of kneecap the entire crypto industry here, or whether you think the SEC is more out to protect maybe the established traditional financial legacies.
Well, I really do appreciate the question. When I think about Grayscale's engagement with the SEC, which dates all the way back to 2016, we've been welcomed with nothing but open arms and open minds. You know, crypto as an asset class is certainly a lot larger and very different from a lot of the other markets that the SEC and other regulators are responsible for overseeing. And what we've found is there is an intense focus on education and wanting to work with industry participants like Grayscale to really make sure they're staying ahead of trends that are happening within the ecosystem, because these assets are evolving quite quickly. I think Chairman Gensler in particular did give some commentary a couple weeks ago that has caused a stir within the market, which is to suggest perhaps that some of the SEC's previous concerns over the Bitcoin market were perhaps resolved and that they were looking forward to reviewing Bitcoin futures-based ETFs. And I think one of the important things that we have to focus on here is that the SEC is really here to help protect the American investor. And so we are believing that the SEC should approve both futures-based ETFs and spot ETFs at the same time and let products like Grayscale Bitcoin Trust and others convert to ETFs and instead really let investors choose how they want to get Bitcoin exposure. So we definitely remain very engaged with the staff and the commission overall and believe that this is just, you know, once again, another opportunity to really focus on education and understanding.
Yeah, because I've heard you be critical of that idea before in the past, too, that they would only approve the futures-tied ETF. And, you know, there are reasons to why that might be problematic, you know, when you think about added fees for the consumer out there. Again, if the idea is for the SEC to be protecting the end investor here, retail investor particularly, I mean, if you saw them kind of approve only the one, the Bitcoin ETF tied to futures that carried more fees, would you then, I guess, kind of move farther into the camp of, all right, what's really going on here at the SEC if they're not, if it doesn't seem that they're trying to stick up for the investor?
I wouldn't rule anything out from the Grayscale perspective. I think it's quite clear that when you look at how successful products like Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, ticker GBTC, have been, there is obviously a very compelling case, not to mention, you know, 8 years of a very strong track record of operational success, of investors getting exposure to Bitcoin in a fund that is physically backed by Bitcoin. The idea of a futures-based product, we are sure can come to the market and have the ability to function successfully, but of course, that is an unproven model. And as you mentioned, could come with more significant costs because of the role that would occur in the underlying futures contracts underpinning the ETF.
Michael, I want to get back to those comments you mentioned about El Salvador and how that could be a template in terms of the adoption in the country for some other emerging markets. You've heard the criticism. Some would argue the rollout has been bumpy. The big sell-off we saw yesterday, just another sign that you can't necessarily see the kind of stability you would with a fiat currency. What other countries do you see going after this model? And what does that template look like if El Salvador's rollout wasn't necessarily a smooth one?
Well, I think the only criticism that's fair of the El Salvador rollout at the moment is just that it happened quickly. But I think that actually quite closely mirrors the momentum that we see within the Bitcoin community. When we think about where adoption rates are taking place, they're highest in the emerging markets, in places like Africa, Southeast Asia, parts of South America. So it would be tough to predict which other countries could possibly think about adopting Bitcoin as legal tender. But certainly we're seeing a gravitation towards Bitcoin, regardless of government action in some of these countries, because a lot of these citizens either don't have access to financial services, or perhaps their local currencies have been debased or have been eroded some way because there hasn't been enough government control over their local currency.
Yeah, and I guess outside of Bitcoin too, I mean, we've seen a lot of enthusiasm pop up in, you know, the other altcoins out there. Of course, you guys also offer, you know, trusts tied to those other ones too. It's come a long way since Bitcoin and Ether. You also have Filecoin and a few other ones in here as well that give people the opportunity who might not want to go the full route and have to deal with it on their own. It's an interesting and important on-ramp here. But particularly when we see the SEC and maybe Brian Armstrong's confusion around what is a security and what's not, Gary Gensler has not necessarily gone farther than just pointing to the Howey test and trying to label what is a security. So if that's really at the heart of what the issue here is around Coinbase's lending piece of the business, does that maybe make you guys take a second look at some of the trusts you're offering? And how do you see maybe that securities definition shaping up?
Well, the Grayscale family of products now comprises 15 unique offerings. And so to your point, that includes both products that offer single asset exposure, as well as products that offer baskets of exposure. In some cases, that's thematic in nature. And we apply a very, very rigorous framework when we determine what products to launch. And we try to mirror as much as possible, not only what we're hearing from investors and the areas of the market that they want exposure to, but also trying to identify compelling opportunities to bring to them. That, of course, certainly includes legal considerations as well as operational considerations, to name a few. And certainly seeing and having the relationship we do with regulators allows us to be proactive in our approach and how we bring products to market.
Well, let's turn our attention to shares of Apple. We are seeing it pull back in the session after a big run-up in the stock. It's now down about 1.2%. Investors now looking ahead to that big September 14th event, dubbed California Streaming, where the tech giant is expected to unveil their new iPhones. Let's bring in Krish Sankar, Cowen Senior Analyst. And Krish, it's good to talk to you today. You know, we have seen a huge run-up in the stock in the lead-up to this event, obviously pulling back just a bit. But what do you see as the big driver, and how big of a catalyst is that event next week likely to be?
Yeah, hi, thanks for having me. I would say definitely the event is partly a catalyst for some of the moon stock. Historically, the stock has done well into the iPhone release. But at the same time, I would say most investors don't have very high expectations for the new iPhone, because most people do believe that the iPhone that's going to be released next week is going to be an iteration of the iPhone 12. You know, you might call it iPhone 13. Some people think that's an unlucky number. It might be called 12S or 14, but it's going to be just like, you know, incremental to what they released last year. The biggest thing we have heard is maybe change in the camera, a little more time of flight. Last year, we used a 5-nanometer chip. This year, it might be more of a 4-nanometer chip, which is just markedly slightly better, but not a whole lot compared to last year. So I think the expectations are that this is not going to be something massively different. It's just going to be incremental compared to last year's iPhone.
Yeah, iPhone 13, you know, 13, hotels and all the other buildings that don't have the 13th floor. We all know who's on the 14th floor. We know we are here. When we talk about the rally that Akiko has been pointing to on Apple here, I mean, it always kind of happens when you do have those big launch events that a lot of people get excited about it. But you're talking about kind of the chips behind all this, and that's obviously been a big push and a big issue for a lot of tech companies here. I mean, how much does that maybe tie into topping out or limiting maybe some of the upside here for Apple?
Yeah, I mean, I think the last earnings call, like Apple management tried to articulate it. If you try to do the math, I think the first half of the calendar year 21, the impact for Apple was more felt on the iPad and the iMac. I think the second half, as you roll into the new iPhone, you're seeing some impact of chip shortages on the iPhone. I think they characterize it as a little over $2 billion or so in impact in the September quarter. But I would say largely, you know, there is some impact, but I think Apple, given its supply chain resilience, is probably slightly better off than most of the others, especially in the iPhone category. So there could be some constraints because of the component shortages. But I would say, largely speaking, I think no one is immune to it, but Apple is slightly in a better position. But does that impact the unit shipments for this year? So far, it doesn't seem like. I think, you know, we've been expecting 90 to 95 million shipment of the new iPhone in the second half of this year, which should be basically late Q3 and calendar Q4. And I don't think that view has changed in the last 2 months in either direction. So hopefully that means, you know, things are at least stable for now.
No delays necessarily with the iPhone, but we have seen those headlines coming out of the Nikkei as well as Bloomberg suggesting there are delays for the Apple Watch, you know, which has seen some pretty big growth here. It's been a big device for Apple in connecting all the services together. How big of a concern is that for you? And what do you see in terms of the hiccups along the way?
Yeah, fair enough, Kika. That's a good question. I would say that, you know, two things. Number one, if you look at it, clearly, you know, iPhone is the biggest product for Apple, and there they seem to be doing pretty well. So that's a positive. And, you know, Apple Watch seems to be impacted a little bit from the component shortages. You also heard a little bit of the iPad, the iMac side, et cetera. And I would say those definitely do add up. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, your Apple Watch is like a $10 to $15 billion business, or somewhere in that range, while the iPhone is probably like, you know, closing in on like $200 billion or so. So I think on that basis, I think the iPhone definitely moves the needle more than the Apple Watch. But all these other component titles that we are seeing outside the iPhone, like the watch and the iPad and iMac, is definitely something to be concerned about. It's definitely a slight negative, but doesn't necessarily move the needle, as in it's not a thesis-changing component type, as I would say.
You may have heard of software as a service, but what about robots as a service? Or in this case, dishwashing robots as a service? This is exactly what's being offered by Dishcraft, a startup that picks up, cleans, and dries dishware and then returns it to restaurants and cafeterias. It's an idea that's become all the more interesting as restaurants face labor shortages and a tougher time finding, you guessed it, dishwashers. And for more on the idea, happy to welcome in the CEO and co-founder of the business, Dishcraft. Linda Puglio joins us right now. And Linda, it's a very interesting idea. And I should note, you guys have raised more than $45 million and attracted some interesting backers, including the co-founder of Netflix, who's been on the show with us many times before. So it's a very interesting and now well-backed idea. But talk to me about why it's better than maybe the old ways of doing things, either by hand or by the OG robot in dishwashing, the dishwasher.
When you automate, you can create much better efficiencies. And so Dishcraft delivers very much like a linen service, where we drop off clean dishes every day, pick up the used ones, bring it back to a centralized hub, and then that hub is powered by robots. This gives us a greater ability to inspect and have very consistent clean quality. So each robot can inspect each ware 22 times. And that's very, very hard to do in a traditional dish room. We also we're able to be much more sustainable. So we use only a quarter of the water and a tenth of the power that a traditional dish room would use. And so it's better for the environment, and it's certainly better for the dining experience, and it's mm-hmm. also better for the operator.
Linda, what does this mean from a cost perspective? I know Zach highlighted the labor shortage right now. I imagine a lot of restaurants and businesses right now would use this service because they just can't hire the dishwashers. But down the line here, what's the trade-off? Is it cheaper to be able to, you know, go run these washers, use the robots, as opposed to hiring somebody on for an hourly wage? What's the difference?
Yeah, it's a great question. We are equal or less than. And so we've had a third-party study done. And in operators using a traditional dish room, we can offer up to 24% savings. And then in an operation that is using compostables or single-use disposable wares and wants to switch to a reusable service, we are equal or even up to 35% savings. Because as you know, right now, cost of compostables, because of supply chain issues, has skyrocketed. And so Dishcraft is a very sustainable and cost-effective solution.
Yeah, that was, the sustainability piece to me was kind of surprising, because you'd think it would be way more sustainable just to throw it in a dishwasher in the restaurant. But you guys are using diesel, I guess, trucks to kind of ship all these things around. I mean, talk to me about that, the benefits on that front relative to just throwing them in the machine.
Because we're able to smartly connect devices, we're able to use cold water and we're able to recycle that. And so we use only a tenth of the power and 25% of the water that is used in a traditional dish room. And so when you couple that even with the driving distance, because we keep everything to a 25-mile radius, we're by far superior to traditional methods or to compostable single-use disposables.
And so how widely is this available right now? And what are you looking at in terms of the biggest opportunities for growth?
So today we're in the Bay Area and we're rapidly expanding here. And in 2022, we are going to across the country. And so we have two cities that we plan to open in Q1, but more on that later.
All right. Well, stay tuned there on that front, but appreciate you coming on. There's a lot of people watching who just would like a normal dishwasher, so maybe that's your market too. A lot of people in New York don't even have that, but Linda Puglia, appreciate you coming on here to chat with us today. Dishcraft CEO and co-founder, be well. You may have heard of software as a service, but what about robots as a service? Or in this case, dishwashing robots as a service? This is exactly what's being offered by Dishcraft, a startup that picks up, cleans, and dries dishware and then returns it to restaurants and cafeterias. It's an idea that's become all the more interesting as restaurants face labor shortages and a tougher time finding, you guessed it, dishwashers. And for more on the idea, happy to welcome in the CEO and co-founder of the business, Dishcraft, Linda Puglia joins us right now. And Linda, it's a very interesting idea, and I should note you guys have raised more than $45 million and attracted some interesting backers, including the co-founder of Netflix, who's been on the show with us many times before. So it's a very interesting and now well-backed idea, but talk to me about why it's better than maybe the old ways of doing things, either by hand or by the OG robot in dishwashing, the dishwasher.
When you automate, you can create much better efficiencies. And so Dishcraft delivers very much like a linen service where we drop off clean dishes every day, pick up the used ones, bring it back to a centralized hub, and then that hub is powered by robots. This gives us a greater ability to inspect and have very consistent clean quality. So each robot can inspect each ware 22 times. And that's very, very hard to do in a traditional dish room. We also we're able to be much more sustainable. So we use only a quarter of the water and a tenth of the power that a traditional dish room would use. And so it's better for the environment And it's certainly better for the dining experience, and it's mm-hmm. also better for the operator.
Linda, what does this mean from a cost perspective? I know Zach highlighted the labor shortage right now. I imagine a lot of restaurants and businesses right now would use this service because they just can't hire the dishwashers. But down the line here, what's the trade-off? Is it cheaper to be able to, you know, go run these washers, use the robots, as opposed to hiring somebody on for an hourly wage? What's the difference?
Yeah. It's a great question. We are equal or less than. And so we've had a third-party study done. And in operators using a traditional dish room, we can offer up to 24% savings. And then in an operation that is using compostables or single-use disposable wares and wants to switch to a reusable service, we are equal or even up to 35% savings. Because as you know, right now, cost of compostables, because of supply chain issues, has skyrocketed. And so Dishcraft is a very sustainable and cost-effective solution.
Yeah, that was, the sustainability piece to me was kind of surprising, because you'd think it would be way more sustainable just to throw it in a dishwasher in the restaurant. But you guys are using diesel, I guess, trucks to kind of ship all these things around. I mean, talk to me about the benefits on that front relative to just throwing them in the machine.
Because we're able to smartly connect devices, we're able to use cold water, and we're able to recycle that. And so we use only a tenth of the power and 25% of the water that is used in a traditional dish room. And so when you couple that even with the driving distance, because we keep everything to a 25-mile radius, we're by far superior to traditional methods or to compostable single-use disposables.
And so how widely is this available right now? And what are you looking at in terms of the biggest opportunities for growth?
So today we're in the Bay Area and we're rapidly expanding here. And in 2022, we are going to across the country. And so we have two cities that we plan to open in Q1, but more on that later.
All right. Well, stay tuned there on that front, but appreciate you coming on. There's a lot of people watching who just would like a normal dishwasher. So maybe that's your market too. A lot of people in New York don't even have that. But Linda Puglia, appreciate you coming on here to chat with us today. Dishcraft CEO and co-founder. Be well.
It's that time of year. The NFL season getting underway tomorrow night. Now the league is pressing forward with plans to complete the season played in full stadiums. We want to talk about what we could expect to see over the next couple of months. And for that, we want to bring in Al Guido. He's a San Francisco 49ers president, also chairman and CEO of Elevate Sports. And we're joined by our reporter, Josh Schaefer, as well. Al, it's good to see you. I know it's going to be an exciting couple or several weeks ahead for you and your team. But just talk to us about what we can expect, because we're coming off of an NFL season, which was successful in many ways, but we saw a number of games postponed because of COVID. So what are you doing to prepare for this season?
Well, I appreciate you having me on first and foremost. You're right. I am excited about the upcoming season. Last year was a season like no other. And, we got all of our games in. It was a tremendous year, hosting the Super Bowl, having all games played, even though some had to be postponed to later dates. But I'm really proud of the National Football League. I'm proud of the San Francisco 49ers. We had a tougher year on the field. We had a lot of injuries and we had to move the last 40 days out of our stadium to Arizona due to COVID, but we're excited for this year. We're looking forward to welcoming fans back to Levi's Stadium. We don't get to do so for two Sundays from now. We're on the road for our first two games, Detroit and then Philadelphia, and then back home on a national primetime game against the Green Bay Packers, but it should be a lot of fun.
Al, when fans do come back to Levi's Stadium, what do you think is going to be different? What are you guys taking that maybe was a pandemic kind of thing that is going to stay and makes the experience different from 2019 to 2021?
You know what, Josh, I think the great thing is, I always say, like, if people ask me all the time, like, what has changed from a COVID perspective? And of course there's the health and safety screenings that happen, which are a little bit different, but the rest of the experience, I would say COVID didn't change anything to per se in the world of sports and entertainment around how we operated. It accelerated everything. And so if you think about it, mobile tickets were already a thing. Now it's a necessity. Contactless was sort of a thing. Now it's a necessity. Cashless was a thing. Now it's a necessity. And so all of those things 49ers will see in our building, and frankly have seen in our building, dating all the way back to 2014 when we opened our new venue. But you're now starting to see that across the rest of the sports and entertainment ecosystem, in venues and stadiums and arenas all over the world, where the technology that we're all using is just more enhanced than probably what we were using before.
So when we talk about the return of live sports and the excitement there, what else can be done to get younger people who might be playing that thing they call soccer to watch football?
Yeah, it's a great question. I got three little girls. They're 12, 10, and 8, and they are huge football fans. They're also huge soccer fans. Yeah, I would say we're not trying to take away from any other sport. We're just trying to add to it. Youth participation in general across sports is down, and I think we all have a desire to want to get more kids out. And that was taken away from a lot of us during COVID. I mean, not only did they were not able to go to schools and they had to learn online, but they weren't able to play their favorite sports on the field, the ice, the court, et cetera. And so, you know, youth fans, I mean, the NFL is growing dramatically as it relates to not just youth fans in the United States, but internationally. And I think when I think about the San Francisco 49ers, there's two ways to think about it. There's the 70,000 fans we entertain on game day, but there's a 10 million plus fans that are in our ecosystem, whether it's in our social and digital channels that follow our content, or frankly, fans that we see on the road when we go to road games. And so it's an opportunity for the National Football League and all of us to really dive into each demographic and meet them where they are. And youth fans are certainly in a different spot. They're not watching it on linear television. They might not even be consuming a full game, but they are consuming snippets of our content. It may be different than maybe what I might consume or my father or my mother might consume, but they are still interested in our game. It's a real true opportunity right now. We have so many great stars, and the 49ers are lucky to have a lot of them, where we got to take their helmets off and get the fans that might not be the diehard fans to really understand who these players are at their core. Because once they do, once they have that love affair, they're connected forever.
Al, with that, what are fans looking for when they're coming back into the stadium to get fans in, right, to draw them to that live experience? What are you finding that stadiums across different sports, maybe even not just the NFL, what are teams needing to add to sort of get fans in and get them obsessed with that live experience again after we've been out of it for, you know, a year or so now?
Well, I think every fan is different, right? Certain fans, they want to understand the health and safety protocols if they might be apprehensive of coming back. Other fans cannot wait to come back. We have seen demand off the charts from back to 2019 numbers. We've never seen ticket sales at this pace, at this pricing. And frankly, not just for the San Francisco 49ers, but in the company that I run, Elevate Sports Ventures, we work with over 150 partners, both in North America Pro 5 and Collegiate. And ticket sales pacing is well above where it was in 2019. So demand is there. Now, the reality when they come to the event, I think there's like, it's not necessarily true in the sense that people like sitting at home on their couch. And like, yes, certain people do. But what we're finding now is in the youth demographic, they really like the social experiment. They really like being back at a sports game. They can't replicate that on their couch. And when something has been taken away from you, and we all lost it during COVID, we lost that going to a game with our friends or our parents or our kids or our colleagues, you forget how special that is. And for me, right, watching games with white noise in the background and no fans in attendance, it's just not as fun as it is with people next to you. There's no other place in America, frankly, no other place in the world where within seconds, you can be an instant friend with a stranger. And that happens at live sports events. You're high-fiving with immediate strangers next to you. And I think that will happen all across the world at live events. We saw it with college football this past weekend. We've seen it with baseball. And now you're about to see it with the NFL. So I don't really think it's going to be that difficult. I think the question is how can we sustain it for the long haul?
Now, we've seen a number of teams look for new ways to make money. Obviously, we're seeing this across various industries, but it's interesting what's happening in sports and also what's happening within the NFL. Today, we had the news that the Jets had reached a deal with Fubo Sportsbook just in terms of exploring opportunities within that space. Where are you seeing some opportunities with the 49ers going forward?
Well, there's no question that, you know, what they call the emerging categories are here and they're here to stay and they've evolved. And so if you think about it, at the national level, we've never seen such high demand for our broadcast rights, which is, you know, got done with our media deals this past offseason. Gambling, crypto, NFTs, we're all seeing it in the world of sports. Every different team is in a is a different path on the life cycle of where they're at right there. Right now, for the 49ers in California, mobile sports betting is not there. And so, you know, from a team's perspective, there's different ways to engage with the legal sports betting community. We do have a partnership with Cache Creek, which is fantastic here locally. But I think when it comes to the San Francisco 49ers fans, and I touched on it, which is, what are we doing for the 70,000 that are in our ecosystem, in our stadium on game day? But almost as important is, what are we doing for the 10 million across the globe? And I think what you'll find now is, not just in these emerging categories of gambling and crypto and NFT, but also what might become of international marketing rights for the National Football League and its teams. They're now about to open up those rights. And so when you think about the 49ers, some people might think about it as the 75-mile or 100-mile radius around our DMA. I think about it as an opportunity to really engage our fans across the globe and to find ways to both grow that fan base and also monetize that fan base as a global brand, which is really what our focus is right now.
And now, while fans are back this year, COVID is still a topic. The Delta variant is still surging and cases are popping up all around the country. I know the 49ers won't be requiring vaccines. Most teams in the league aren't. Most stadiums in the league won't be requiring vaccines. Can you just walk us through what that process was like? What did you guys sort of evaluate there? And do you think that's something that might be fluid as the season continues on?
I think everything in the pandemic is fluid for sure. I'm not an infectious disease expert, so we employ on our medical advisory three of the world's most renowned infectious disease experts to help guide us at the San Francisco 49ers. And so we're following all local and state guidelines right now. And Josh, I think everyone's in a different bucket here, right? When you think about the California and Northern California, Northern Bay Area, about 80% of our citizens are vaccinated. And so, you know, that might be different than another market per se. And so while today we're not requiring that, we'll follow all state and local guidelines. I feel, and I think our fans feel based on our surveys, that they feel incredibly safe. They can't wait to come back to the venue, that we're doing everything possible to keep them healthy. But you're right, it is a fluid situation. While it's not 2020, it's not 2019. And we are going to have to live with the reality that we are in COVID. There is no new normal. This is just the way in which we're going to have to operate as sports teams, leagues, and entertainment companies. And the reality is, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you what that looks like in the future. All I can tell you is that we will employ and work with the people who know the best. We will follow the science. And right now in our community, our leaders have done a great job getting everyone vaccinated. Our staff is fully vaccinated. Those who are working the game days are fully vaccinated. We have one of the highest percentage rates in the NFL from a player vaccination perspective. So I feel incredibly positive about what we're about to do this coming Sunday and throughout the rest of the course of the season. But we got 17 regular season games to get through, and that goes all the way through January and then into February for the Super Bowl. So I promise you that we'll be spend every waking minute working really hard to make sure our fans are safe.
Let's jump to the Super Bowl. This just crossed as you were speaking the wires. NBC is setting a record for Super Bowl ad rates, $6.5 million. And they're also going to have cryptocurrency as part of the new sponsor categories. Any quick reaction to that? It just up and away.
Honestly, not surprised. I think when you look at what's happened over COVID, but frankly, what's happening over the last 5 years, if you think about live sports and entertainment, and frankly, what we're on right now is sort of news, right? Those are the two things that are trending from a consumption. Sports really is not an on-demand product. You're not watching it in replay. You're watching it live. And I think there's a lot to be said for the eyeballs, and a lot gets reported around this rating point or that rating point. If you look at the National Football League and who's watching it and who's consuming it 7 days a week, and you think about the growth of that relative to precipitous decline, maybe in other forms of content, it's not surprising to me that brands, partners, emerging categories and technologies are looking at the world of sports to use that as a segue or to use that as an education and or a platform to get their company more well-known and in the hands of, frankly, people. If you're a B2C company, for people that are engaging in it, and if you're a B2B company, all of the partners and sponsors that are aligned with the National Football League.
A new COVID milestone in the United States, 75% of adults here in the USA have at least one of their vaccine doses. So we're going to hear President Biden talk about this. He's expected to tomorrow. We also have the WHO urging nations like ours not to proceed with booster shots. We're going to talk about all of this with Dr. Jeremy Faust. He is emergency medicine physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital. It's good to have you here, doctor. I want to ask you a simple question. Article in the New York Times, I think it was yesterday, that there's a 1 in 5,000 chance for a breakthrough case, that we're all getting very worked up if you're vaccinated about breakthrough cases. And then they went on to say it's really 1 in 10,000. If that's the reality, are we all overreacting to what's happening with this different variant that sent so many people to the hospital?
Thanks for having me. I think that we have to be very clear about who we're talking about. The Delta variant is extraordinarily dangerous for the unvaccinated, and it presents a problem for the vaccinated that the previous variant did not, but they're not in the same ballpark. When we see the implications of most breakthrough infections, it is a small fraction of the problem that we saw without vaccination. So yeah, I think that Delta is an uncomfortable development because it makes it much worse for people who have no protection, who are unvaccinated, and it causes more breakthrough cases than any other variant has in the past, and a small subset of those people do have severe illness. The question is to what to do about it, and I'm not convinced that boosting everybody is actually what's necessary given the numbers that I've been crunching.
So what do you think is necessary then at this point? I guess who should be getting a booster shot right now?
Well, anyone who tells you the answer to that question is making it up because it hasn't been studied carefully enough for anyone to really say. We know from Israel data that boosting seniors has a short-term benefit in terms of decreasing infections, but we have no idea how long that benefit lasts, and it's very likely that it's a very short-term benefit, and that's fine if you want to flatten a curve, but I don't think that we would expect that boost to suddenly render everyone impervious to infection forever again. It seems like a band-aid. Now, again, if you are a very small country with a limited hospital capacity, that might be worth doing, but you can only do it so often. In terms of younger people, we really need to know what the benefit added is, because the booster, the vaccine already provides tremendous protection against severe illness and worse. And we now know that the vaccine also decreases long COVID, we think. And so what is a third dose going to do to young people? And we'd like to know if a third dose has any side effects that really start to crop up. After the first dose, we had a couple of side effects, small numbers in young people. After the second dose, it went up. Will a third dose make it go further? Or is it so far in time spaced away that it's more like the first dose? We don't know. And that's a great study question, but it's a bad thing to just roll it out and see. So I think that given that we don't have a real emergency on our hands with respect to breakthrough hospitalizations, in the sense of we're not having hospitals overflowing with that, it would be very wise to study what we should actually do rather than guessing.
With all of these people who are unfortunately getting the new variant and becoming ill, are we not also, though, building immunity as a larger population? I mean, when do we get to the point where it's like the flu? There are obviously tragic cases of the flu, but we all live a normal life without freaking out.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the answer to that is going to be emerging in the coming weeks when we see what kind of rates we actually are recording in terms of serious illness. What I can tell you here in Massachusetts is that we've had a rise in cases and in hospitalizations during the Delta era, but we have not had excess mortality. We have not actually had a real catastrophic increase in overall deaths the way we did in every other wave so far. And that's because the vaccine does what it was meant to do, which is, for the most part, keep people from being hospitalized and having severe illness and death. So the question as to what risk we accept, I think that has to be something that every community has for itself. But one thing I would say is I think it's a very different conversation to have when everybody's eligible, because I still think that even though pediatric cases that go bad are relatively rare. It's tragic to think of a 5 or 6-year-old having a bad outcome when we know that once we have safety data on the vaccine, 95% of those 95% of those outcomes would be preventable. So once everyone's eligible, I think it's a different conversation is to say, well, risk tolerance in one place is different than the next. But until everyone's eligible, it's a little bit, to me, it seems a little unfair to have that. And we're close. So I think that in the next few weeks to months, we should be able to do that.
Doctor, we're expected to hear from President Biden tomorrow. He's supposed to speak on the Delta variant, also where we stand with vaccinations. What do you think his message should be, or what do you think his message needs to be tomorrow?
His message absolutely needs to be that people with zero doses of vaccine in their body are the ones who are at risk, and that therefore the number one priority actually has to be getting the unvaccinated a first and second dose of the mRNA vaccines, because that's what's going to really change the numbers that we see on our screens every day of how many deaths there are. That is number one. Focusing on boosting, I think, is not a great idea, because it's just those are at the margins. The marginal return on that is actually probably pretty limited and probably pretty short-lived. I think that he needs to focus on that. I think he needs to focus on the idea of using our national resources to make tests available at the point of use. So a rapid test at school is a lot better than a PCR test that's a day or two old. And I think the government has a role in paying for that. I think that until we have everyone vaccinated, we need to try to limit spread. So testing and providing masks to people who don't have access to good masks, those are the things that I would like to see in the plan. But I think that there's been so much conversation about boosting that we've kind of forgotten about the basic things, which is let's slow this down until everyone is fully protected.